Tonight I will speak of what is at the heart of the Jewish faith, food. And in order to illustrate why food is so important to Jewish life, I will cite one of the more amusing human interest stories that relates to the Judaic culinary experience. The story was sparked on May 16, 2012, a day that will live in infamy. It was announced that the brand of Trader Joe's semi-sweet chocolate chips, which had been labeled by its rabbinic supervisor as parv, neither dairy nor meat, and therefore usable by observant Jews with both, was now changing and was going to be labeled from now on as dairy, meaning it could not be utilized anymore with a meat meal. This caused a crisis. Now, why is this so important? Apparently, Trader Joe's is the gold standard of non-dairy chocolate chips, utilized as the chip of choice for baking for the Sabbath in desserts following meat meals. Suddenly, it seemed that if they were now dairy, or at least utilized with dairy, then bakers would no longer be able to eat those cookies immediately after the Shabbat meal. And this was a tremendous crisis for many observant Jews. According to the Times of Israel, quote, "While many so-called Hamish brands, Jewish companies that make only kosher foods, produce parv chocolate chips, those chips are generally waxy and flavorless. The silky, rich Trader Joe's morsels melt to perfect consistency in cookies and taste like actual chocolate. They are good enough to almost make up for the fact that kosher bakers have to forego real butter in cookies they serve after a Shabbat lunch of grilled chicken, roasted vegetables, and quinoa salad." End quote. We can therefore understand why, as soon as this announcement was made, many Jews immediately stormed to Trader Joe's to get the last remaining packages of the non-dairy semi-sweet chocolate chips. I quote from a Pittsburgh Jewish newspaper, quote, "The chocolate chip stockpile frenzy began immediately thereafter with local and national consumers sweeping the shelves of the remaining chocolate chips and ordering them by the case. The store manager of the Trader Joe's in East Liberty confirmed the rush, and a store representative at the Trader Joe's in the South Hills said that customers were ordering them by the case, including one order for five cases. The Kislinski family spent $650 for three cases of chips. I have five women in my house. That's a lot of demand for chocolate. They eat this stuff like a snack," said Macy Kislinski, referring to his wife and four daughters. "We'll go through a couple of bags a week, and not just for baking. It's in pancakes, waffles, banana bread, brownies." End quote. So significant was the outcome that this emergency was featured in America's true paper of record, the New York Post, which featured the brilliant headline, "Chips Ahoy Vey." The Post reported this story in its usual calm, objective style, which has made them the gold standard, or if you will, the Trader Joe's chocolate chips of the journalistic world. Quote, this is the New York Post story. "Observant Jews across the country were hit by a plague of Old Testament proportions when a wildly popular brand of chocolate chips sold only at Trader Joe's lost a crucial part of its kosher label. The semi-sweet chocolate chips had been labeled parv kosher because they were dairy-free. But the makers recently changed the way they clean the equipment, putting chips into bags on a production line that also processes milk chocolate. Because of that, kosher certifiers yanked the parv label on May 18th. The ruling, the paper adds, prompted kosher-keeping Jews to rush out and stock up. We've been sold out since Saturday. It's been a madhouse, said a worker at a Trader Joe's in Regal Park. I never saw anything go so fast, said another. Home bakers were so upset, they took to Facebook. Some even tried to hawk the remaining bags on eBay. And then the New York Post cites a woman who is described as an Orthodox mom of three from Queens, who said the following. This is a huge hit for us. If you keep kosher and wanted a great dessert after a meat meal, you could serve these amazing chocolate chip cookies and brownies. My kids love them. And then she said, there's no substitute for Trader Joe's. Why would they do something like this? End quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the one hand, it bears stressing that what is sought here by these shoppers is not hedonism, but rather the genuine enjoyment of the Sabbath meal, a sacred moment of family togetherness. But the story does reflect how the vastness of the food options available today are so different from what was available to so many Jews in the past. After all, it could certainly be said about much of Ashkenazic cuisine that it was a result of doing the best one could with the limited options and available ingredients. And yet at the same time, this very same cuisine ensured, in the midst of many challenges and hardships, the joyous sanctification of the Sabbath and other sacred days. It is this sanctification through faith and food that we ponder in our discussion of one of my favorite books, Miriam's Kitchen by Elizabeth Ehrlich. This is a book about food, and it is a book about faith. It is a book about the Holocaust, and it is also a cookbook. It has reflections on American Jewish assimilation, and it also has recipes. The writer Elizabeth Ehrlich describes herself growing up in a family with much Jewish culture, but little observed religion, being brought as a child to synagogue in Yom Kippur, I believe, only once. Yet she knew that observance several generations back had been part of her family life. Then she got married and she grew to know and love her husband's parents, Holocaust survivors, who have in the book the pseudonyms Jacob and Miriam. For Jacob and Miriam, her in-laws, food is central to the Jewish sanctification of life and part and parcel of a living, observed Judaism. For Miriam, the mother-in-law, the recipes were particularly important because in Poland, food had been the way in which her family had made a living. Elizabeth writes about her mother-in-law, quote, "Miriam's mother owned a restaurant in Poland before the war. The tables were full. Middle-class Jewish families from the village came to dine, travelers between trains, Polish officers from the army base nearby. The fish dishes were famous. Miriam, as a little girl, would be shooed from the hot, busy kitchen where two peasant girls helped her mother, and a man opened barrels of beer. Her father delivered the beer. He held the bottling concession at the brewery nearby, a license bestowed by the local lord and landowner, good for 20 years. Thus, the recipes that Miriam bears are from her family's restaurant in Poland, from the place where her mother made food for so many. This food Miriam utilizes to mark Jewish time, to bring holiness to Jewish life. But the recipes are part of her own heritage, passed down from woman to woman, generation to generation. But because so many members of Miriam's family were murdered in the Holocaust, this also means that for Miriam to remember these recipes is for her to recall a generation that was consumed in an inferno of Jew hate. And Jew hate not only from the Nazis. Elizabeth Ehrlich tells us of Miriam's return after surviving the Holocaust to the place where her mother had once run her restaurant, cooking for Jew and non-Jew. Miriam, we are told, found a non-Jewish former friend. Ehrlich writes about Miriam, quote, "After the war, she and other survivors returned to the village, crossing the Vistula River in the first civilian train back. A school chum was living in her parents' house. I thought they got you all," said the friend, closing the door. End quote. Miriam's recipes thus embody the memory of the tradition and faith of so many that are no longer here. Elizabeth Ehrlich tells us that while she first met Miriam as the mother of her future husband, her relationship with her mother-in-law's recipes and her Judaic way of life changed after she, herself, Elizabeth, had a daughter. She writes, "Upon becoming a mother, I wondered what to teach my children. I wanted to build a floor under my children, something strong and solid." This, in turn, led her to Miriam's recipes, which in turn led her to Miriam's Judaism. "What," Ehrlich writes, "made me value my inheritance as treasure, not burden. The luck that has placed me as an adult in range of Miriam's kitchen. My mother-in-law Miriam, born in a small village in Jewish Poland, survived the Holocaust. A keeper of rituals and recipes and of stories. She cooks to recreate a lost world and to prove that unimaginable loss is not the end of everything. She is motivated by duty to ancestors and descendants, by memory and obligation and an impossible wish to make the world whole. When I am with Miriam in the kitchen, she speaks of the past. I listen, trying to imagine the world from which her cuisine came. With this in mind, we can understand why I began with the Trader Joe's story of the semi-sweet chocolate chips. Not because I love the journalistic style of the New York Post, though of course I do, but rather because I think this book, Miriam's Kitchen, serves for us, Jews in America, as a course corrective. It's not only a book for Jews looking to rediscover the traditions of the past. It's also a book for those who today are fully observant, but who wish to discover the true role of food in our faith. I'll begin by addressing this subject, the role of food in Judaism, and then turn to the unique lessons of Miriam's life that Elizabeth Ehrlich eloquently reveals. Why is food so important in Jewish living? The fact is that Judaism is what the Jewish theologian Michael Wishergrad calls a religion of the body, meaning its vision of holiness is very much linked to the physical realm and to the most physical of experiences, including eating. The central cultic ritual in the times of the temple was the assembly of all Israel 3 times a year in Jerusalem, where the Bible constantly exhorts, "V'achaltem sham lifnei Hashem Elokeichem." When you bring sacrifices, when you bring offerings there, you shall eat them in Jerusalem before the Lord your God. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik once noted how shocking to some of the philosophically minded the Jewish idea of dining with the divine in Jerusalem might have seemed. As Rabbi Soloveitchik put it, such a commandment was, quote, incomprehensible to Greek philosophy. Meaning, how could it be that the highest state was an act of eating? For the Greeks, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, an animal eats while man thinks and recognizes the spiritual. Nevertheless, Rabbi Soloveitchik adds that for Jews, actually, if you look in the Torah, there are so many more commandments related to eating than, say, to prayer. And he writes, and this is my own translation, from the Hebrew, the halacha prefers eating before God, meaning eating in the presence of God, over prayer. Again, Jewish law prefers eating before God over prayer. And I always thought that it would have been a great, if I had had a college yearbook, which I didn't, but it would have been a great yearbook quote for me. Judaism prefers eating over prayer, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. But he goes on to explain what he means. Eating sacrifices, eating the Paschal lamb, eating the second tithe. In other words, these are commandments of eating. He gives more examples. Eating matzah, eating the offerings of joy on the 3 festivals. All these are biblical commandments of the Torah 613, according to all opinions, while prayer is counted among the commandments only according to Maimonides. The mitzvah of rejoicing on the festivals in the temple, he writes, is focused on eating sacrificial meat, and in our time on eating regular meat and drinking wine. And this is considered the rejoicing of man before the Creator. Judaism, in other words, is a physical faith that focuses on sanctifying physical pleasures. This because of the Jewish understanding of the very essence of human identity. Man is understood by Judaism to be a composite of both body and soul. Both are part of who we are. And if our religion was entirely spiritual, if there was no physical component of our worship, of our relationship with the divine, then God would not truly have a relationship with us, qua us. He would only have a relationship with our souls. Thus, the Jewish fusion of faith and food is to be contrasted with the philosophical tradition stemming from Socrates and Plato, which insisted that only our souls are our true selves. According to the Platonic approach, man must attempt to transcend the physical, to escape the body imprisoning the soul intellectually by attempting to perceive what is beyond this world and to establish thereby a relationship between the spirit and the eternal. Socrates, in Plato's dialogue, the Phaedo, consoles his distraught students after he is sentenced to death, telling them that after he is executed, his soul will fly free to a glorious afterlife and to a more truly to a non-corporeal life where the truth will be evident. The notion that only our souls or our consciousness or our minds is essentially us and not our bodies is not the Jewish view, and there are non-Jewish thinkers that have disputed it as well. There's a very moving passage written by the Christian theologian Richard John Neuhaus in his book, As I Lay Dying. Struck by illness, Neuhaus ponders what it means for one's body to die. He ardently believes in a spiritual afterlife, and yet he adds that the spirit is not all that he is. Listen to this passage. I think it's truly literarily wondrous. He writes, "The notion of some of the ancients and the Enlightenment rationalists that the essential I is not involved in the death of this body struck me as preposterous. It is this body," he adds, "now in pitiful ruins, that participated in the yearnings of my loves, the bracing joy of early morning walks. Not to mention," he further writes, "the sounds of Mozart and the taste of a surprisingly fine Merlot at the Italian restaurant up the street. The body remembers." And then he has the most beautiful sentence. "Even my thinking is sensuous. As I lay there going back in memory, my recollections are tactile, touching the burlap of disappointments and running my fingers over the velvet of joys recalled. This body and I, this body that is inseparable from me, together we have been this life." Neuhaus puts it accurately and exquisitely. And this is a much more eloquent way of saying what Yogi Berra once expressed when he said that baseball is 90% mental and the other half is physical. As much as we may wish to transcend our physical selves, as much as we may assert that we are 90% spiritual, we can't ignore the fact that our bodies are an essential part of our humanity. We are an amalgam of the mortal and the immortal. And though for traditional Judaism our soul does live on when our body dies, nevertheless Judaism obligates us in avelut, in mourning a death, because we recognize that in death a fundamental feature of human existence is lost, even though we believe that in resurrection it will ultimately be regained. Our identities cannot be limited to our souls. And thus, halakhic Judaism, traditional Judaism, insists that man's embodied existence with all its drives and desires provides one with the opportunity to serve God with every aspect of one's humanity. Achieving a fully human relationship with God in a way that no purely spiritual being ever could. And that is why so many mitzvahs of the Torah refer to the physical, and perhaps above all to eating. The Torah is not about escaping this world, escaping our corporeality. It's about sanctifying this world in our physical lives. In his own wonderful book about food, Leon Kass ponders how, while both animals and humans eat, human beings have the ability to eat in a noble fashion. And he gives an example that illustrates how eating nobly doesn't make it any less physical. He writes as follows. "It is tempting to suggest that nobility consists in rising above or transcending our animality through acts of what one might call self-levitation. Like the ballerina who defies gravity, so the graceful eater defies neediness and eats as if he were not compelled to do so." In other words, we might think this. But, he writes, "the ballerina does not so much defy as exploit gravity. Similarly also, the moderate and graceful human eater exploits animal necessity. He shapes a virtue out of a necessity." In other words, truly noble eating takes the animalistic aspect of ourselves, hunger, the desire for food, the desire to enjoy food, and we are meant to take it and not ignore it, but channel it. And for Judaism, even more important than the graceful eater is the sacred eater. By joining ritual, family, and food, we take one of the most physical and seemingly animalistic aspects of existence and we make it holy. The Jewish approach to food is best captured, perhaps, and really to the entire physical world, is best captured, perhaps, in an anecdote of one of the most famous students of my great-great-grandfather, Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibowitz. We are told that a denizen of Rabbi Leibowitz's town once brought him a chicken stomach in which a needle had been found. Because a hole in the stomach, and the stomach is called kurkavan in the parlance of the Talmud, because a hole in the stomach renders the chicken treif, non-kosher, this was a potential halakhic problem when a needle was found in the stomach. Did it make a hole or not? And so he brings the stomach of the chicken to the rabbi. Now the rabbi himself had spent his entire life in the academy, and he knew a great deal about this question, but he had never seen an actual specimen of said stomach, an experience that was de rigueur for the shtetl housewife of his day. And so, according to the tale, as the woman brought this stomach to him, he grabbed the bloody, pulpy mass of chicken stomach, held it near him, and exultantly exclaimed in Yiddish, "Ah, das ist der heilige Kurkavan, this is the holy stomach on which so much Torah has been written." Judaism, contra Plato, denies that this is a world of material shadow that the enlightened soul must escape. Jews insist that by sanctifying the physical, the presence of God resides in this world, and thus, gefilte fish and matzah and chalant, or Sephardic Shabbat chamin, and so many other foods, are culinary concoctions that may seem like lowly substances, but they are in their own ways foods of faith, and eating them with a proper perspective allows our tables to be nothing less than dwelling places of the divine. And that is why Jewish thought has always approached food and taste as a subject worthy of study, and that has set Judaism apart from Greek philosophy. Thus, the food writer John McQuaid tells us that, quote, "For thousands of years, scientists and philosophers have viewed taste and flavor as less than worthy subjects for study. The ancient Greeks considered taste to be the lowest and grossest form of the senses. Vision can discern the subtleties of high art or the smile of a loved one. But taste's mission is simple, to distinguish food from everything else. The Greeks thought the temptations it posed in carrying out that mission clouded the mind." In other words, the Greeks loved vision and spurned the importance of taste. Judaism is the opposite. For Judaism, visual images, statues, icons, are possibly dangerous if misused, can be turned toward pagan approaches to the divine. But Judaism has always placed eating at the center of its theology, so that our virtues are imbibed as children, not only intellectually but physically, so that we can taste our very values, the food of our faith, on the tip of our tongue. It's with this in mind that we can appreciate the way in which food, Miriam's recipes, become the medium by which her daughter-in-law Elizabeth rediscovers Judaism itself, the cadence of its way of life. The physicality of food, the existential element of taste, is essential to the experience. It's a tangible connection to past, to sanctity. Thus, as Elizabeth describes how she ultimately came to kosher her kitchen, she perfectly captures the fusion of physical and spiritual at the heart of the Jewish kitchen by writing as follows. It's discipline, a kosher kitchen. It's an encompassing way of life in which discipline and meaning, the mundane and the spiritual, are inextricably tied. You are only washing your dishes, but you are doing something more. You are tending something ancient, and it matters. The meat knife matters. Your work matters. To this, Elizabeth adds in a moving passage how she learned from Miriam to connect with the past, and thereby she remembers some of her own Jewish experiences and her own family history as well. Ehrlich writes as follows. "I am trying to learn Miriam's recipes anew. I am trying to learn Miriam's recipes now. For me, it is a voyage of discontinuity and connection. Some of her dishes and expressions and perceptions I remember from the kitchens of my childhood. The cadence is different, reflecting the differences finally between refugees like Miriam and those like my grandmothers who emigrated at least somewhat by choice, and those who, like my parents, leave their immigrant homes to seek their own Americas. The cadence is evolving for me now as I seek to bring tradition home. With ambivalence and some sense of irony, I light a candle, recite a prayer, grate a potato, and move toward making my kitchen kosher. Thus, I forge links from my grandparents and my husband's grandparents to my children, who wear their ancestors' Hebrew names. I think about it as I go, from a sink side, stove side, personal perspective, not a rabbinical one. I turn over the old stories in my mind and collect new ones. I choose my own history, deciding which snapshots, decades, recipes, versions of arguments and events are to be discarded, and which will stand for the whole." And then she adds the following. "That history is my own little temple, where I measure my life against a reliable standard. Increasingly, I find meaning there." Again, that history is my own little temple. It's a wonderful phrase, and it captures what a kitchen, in a certain sense, is for Judaism. We Jews tend to refer to a synagogue as a mikdash ma'at, a tiny temple. But of course, a synagogue sanctuary is almost entirely spiritual, whereas the aspects of Judaism that one experienced in Jerusalem's temple, the aspects of Judaism that one experienced in Jerusalem's Temple Mount, the smells, the physicality, the very experience of dining with the divine, these aspects are the mark, first and foremost, of the Jewish home, and especially the Jewish kitchen. It's not too much to say that in the book, Miriam's kitchen becomes a sacred place, with Miriam playing the role of the priest, the Kohen. The book is written by Elizabeth Ehrlich according to the calendar cycle, with the foods and recipes of the various holidays, from Rosh Hashanah to through Chanukah and Purim and ultimately Pesach and Shavuot. Thus is Miriam's kitchen transformed into a tiny temple of holiness, embodying to all readers, those that grew up with Jewish observance and those that did not, the very nature of the rhythms of Jewish life, not only in the present, but connecting across time. And it is connection to the past that teaches the reader, above all, about the meaning of Jewish life. Ehrlich writes that Miriam's cooking, quote, is a way to teach the children right and wrong, consciousness, history, and appreciation of all we have. It connects them to their grandparents and mine. It is an ancient religion. It beckons, and half the time I'm not even sure why. Its rituals tantalize and will not be denied. What, she writes, is the lure of ritual when passionate belief is hardly ever to be found, when fulfillment of ritual is a matter of choice. It is more than the preservation of an empty vessel. It is the conviction deep and unspoken that ritual, that the vessel, contains a precious substance, though I cannot name it. My ignorance is my problem, not that of the vessel. Why do I, having long ignored the rituals, yearn in their direction? Some of its caretakers have been those I loved best and respected most. I cannot forget them. I start from there. In touching the past, in other words, she feels responsibility to the past and toward posterity. And of course, Jewish connection to the past also allows her to commune with its pain. And this is a prominent theme in the book. For in learning Miriam's recipes as she cooks in the kitchen and teaches her daughter-in-law, Elizabeth also learns of Miriam's history. Indeed, the two go hand in hand, so that the horrors of the Holocaust will be described in one paragraph, and then recipe or baking or cooking in the next. And in a way that you would have expected to be odd, the book oscillates back and forth between the monstrous and the mundane, from a tale of what Miriam has lost to the holidays for which she is preparing. But it's not odd. Rather than being strange, the sense of Miriam's suffering allows us to better appreciate the sanctity of her food and the fortitude of her faith. I wrote in the Wall Street Journal after October 7th about the holiday in which the horrific attack occurred, Simchat Torah, and I noted that the Jewish sense of joy comes on that holiday from beginning the Torah again, which Jews take to be a sign of the eternity of the Jewish people, and our ability to constantly start anew after facing those who attempt to destroy us. And how Judaism's joy draws from our deep sense, built on the Jewish past, of the vulnerability of Jewish life, which in turn enhances our appreciation of the preciousness of life and of the joyous opportunities to make the experience of life sacred. Similarly, in discussing the other festival celebration of the Torah, Shavuot, Elizabeth Ehrlich describes Miriam baking cheese danishes for the holiday with the recipe of her grandmother, knowing that so many of the women in the family that would have made those danishes were murdered. Ehrlich writes the following, describing Miriam's grandmother and her own daughter's ancestor. Quote, "The great-grandmother showed her five daughters how to do, and they were to transmit the knowledge to daughters of their own. The four sons, meaning the other children of this woman who had the recipe, might have brought home four wives eager to learn Poland's best cheese danishes, wives who too would have passed the recipe along. By now, if the world were a just place, dozens of kitchens, genetically linked, should have been busy this pre-festival Friday with rolling pins, graters, and spoons, turning out these very danishkas. Instead, it has come to this. Miriam, an only child who came out of the war with a mother, two aunts, and an uncle, showing me on behalf of a single granddaughter." So she is describing the destruction of a family and a small remnant remaining And then almost right after that, Elizabeth writes about the danishes themselves. We make the filling. Miriam pushes the farmer cheese through a grater. She mixes the farmer cheese, half a beaten egg, vanilla sugar, sour cream, sugar, yellow raisins. So ladies and gentlemen, does this connection between terrible past and placid present ruin the experience of eating the danishes? Does it make celebrating Shavuot less joyous, less meaningful? On the contrary, it endows the danishes and Shavuot itself with a sense of sacred obligation, of continuity, of responsibility, of sanctity, and ultimately of victory over those who attempted to destroy us in the past. For in every generation, they rise up against us to destroy us. Ehrlich herself imagines what continuing the cooking for a festive holiday using the recipe of a murdered grandmother must mean to Miriam. Ehrlich writes, I'm sure the flavor is altered when you have lived Miriam's life. Yet serious cooking is an essentially optimistic act. It reaches into the future, vanishes into memory, and creates the desire for another meal. A stunningly beautiful sentence that captures the Jewish awareness of the vulnerability of life and simultaneously the hope and the joy expressed in sanctifying and marking another holiday meal. All this is expressed in simple foods, humble recipes for cheese danishes or lakshin and lebarin, noodles and liver, and so much more. When the recipes and traditions, the sanctification and the joy of the preciousness of Jewish life go hand in hand, observant Jews like myself reading this, reading about Miriam, are forced to reconsider how today, when we have so much, when you can get kosher Wagyu beef and sushi of every kind, when kosher restaurants are advertising the latest cuisine, whether we are in danger of losing our sense of reverence for how Jews like Miriam brought sanctity into her kitchen with such privation and in the face of such hate from so many. I will acknowledge my own interests or perhaps my flaws. I am a foodie, and I will continue to enjoy these new foodie experiences, as I will continue to enjoy single malt scotch, and above all, Japanese whiskey. But Elizabeth Ehrlich's book reminds us that the Jewish approach to food embraces eating, but that eating is about holiness, not hedonism. Elizabeth Ehrlich tells us that when she got engaged, Miriam, who lived so simple a life, wanted her son's wedding to be an extravaganza. And she tells us why. She writes, Miriam wanted a big festive wedding. She yearned for an occasion, a simcha, an abandoned few hours of gaiety and plenty and unhampered celebration for the marriage of her only son. For Miriam and Jacob, life, essential daily life, is not about the pursuit of pleasure. Much of life indeed has brought them grief. Yes, there was nachas, pleasure along the way, mostly when their children were young. They have welcomed security, community, the achievements of those they love. In everyday life, though, they do not seek pleasure for its own sake, do not splurge in restaurants, do not take lavish vacations, do not indulge in shopping sprees. They do not indulge themselves in any way, not out of self-denial, but rather out of modest habits, a sense of proportion and self-sufficiency, which I admire. Against this backdrop, she continues, describing her in-laws, my husband's parents believe in the concept of the simcha, a baby naming, a graduation, a bar mitzvah. Such things deserve a party, and the party is worth working for, saving for, putting many eggs in one basket for. When the rare great occasion of life rolls in, my husband's parents rise up to meet it, clapping and singing. The contrast with everyday life, perhaps, elevates the joy. So she writes, and this is worth remembering. As much as I enjoy an evening out at a nice restaurant, we have to remember which aspects of life are truly worth celebrating. A baby naming, a bar mitzvah, a wedding, the perpetuation of the Jewish family and of Jewish tradition. And enjoyment of food in these moments is truly sanctified. For this was the lesson, through recipes and much else, that our ancestors passed on to all of us. And to eat as a Jew is to commune with them again. The most famous modern reflection about food comes from Proust in his description of biting into a madeleine and is suddenly summoned back to the memory of his own childhood. Proust's description was then repurposed in the Pixar film Ratatouille, where a food critic comes to a fancy French restaurant, and rather than being offered foie gras or beef bourguignon, he is given a simple vegetable dish that suddenly summons up the memories of the humble meal his own mother used to make for him. Elizabeth Ehrlich reminds us that in the end, food traditions are our way of discovering not just our personal memories, but our collective consciousness as Jews. And that in the end, it doesn't matter all that much if we have Wagyu beef or even totally, truly excellent dairy-tasting, non-dairy chocolate chips. Taste is, of course, essential to the experience, and the effort in cooking is also important. After all, we all know that grated potato latkes made by hand are always going to be better than a mix. But what Elizabeth allows us to appreciate is how in the end the sacred and the physical together make the experience of eating what it is. I therefore close with the last passage of the book Miriam's Kitchen, in which Ehrlich describes how the physicality of her now kosher kitchen, with the right perspective, enhances even the simplest of experiences. She tells us in this passage that she has a meat soup that she wishes to reheat, but it's not so simple because she has not cleaned up from the last milchig meal, and so dairy foodstuffs are everywhere. She writes, quote, "I have what is at the moment a dairy kitchen, a dirty milchdicke kitchen, and I stand in it under unflinching electric light, bearing a cranberry glass storage bowl sealed with a plastic lid, like some holy grail filled with cold fleischige, meaning meat, barley soup. The blue rack is in the sink under the dairy dishes. The dishwasher is half full of dairy dishes. Every surface glistens with milk fat, the counter, the table, the chairs. Something nameless is stuck to the bottom of my foot. There are four different sponges lying in wait on my sink, blue for dairy, pink for meat, green for parv, and yellow to clean the kitchen. Nearby, three kitchen towels, blue, pink, and green. I should wipe the table with the yellow sponge, and I should wipe the table with the yellow sponge, and thereon set down the cranberry glass bowl. I should wash the dishes with the blue sponge, stack the dishwasher, and run it. I should wash the blue rack, dry it with a blue dish towel, and set it aside. I should bag the trash, sweep the floor, use the yellow sponge to wash the counter and scour the kitchen sink. I should rinse the sink with boiling water and lay down the white sink rack. Then, yes, then I could prepare my fleishig meal. Gently reheating soup in a saucepan, sitting down to soup in a white soup plate, and later wash it all and dry it, saucepan, black ladle, soup plate, meat spoon, cranberry glass storage bowl, with pink sponge and pink towel. However, she continues, life is a fleeting thing. I know what I will do. I will put the whole glass bowl in the microwave and zap it. I will rummage about for a meat spoon. I will dim the lights, and when the timer beeps, I will peel the plastic lid from the glass bowl, lean against the counter, and eat the soup standing up, hoping my husband will call from Ohio, where he is away on a business trip. Then I will leave the unwashed bowl and spoon on the furthest corner of the counter to deal with tomorrow." And then she concludes, "It is as good as any soup I have ever had." Elizabeth Ehrlich is right. Life is indeed a fleeting thing. And the moments of sanctity fused with joy are so precious. When we realize this, we will focus in our fleeting lives on the moments that matter most. Thank you very much.